Hello, this is Tom Scott with the Ford County Chronicle for Wednesday, May 20th, 2026. We begin on the front page, good news for the city of Paxton. Progress on the horizon. Upgrades coming to downtown using an $850,000 federal grant as city takes steps towards creation of a second tax increment financing district. The $850,000 federal grant to be used to enhance 100 block of South Market Street, Paxton. Thanks to the efforts of Mayor Bill Ingold and other city officials, honorary James Kingston Way is getting even more upgrades. Ingold announced during the Paxton City Council's monthly meeting on Tuesday, May 12th, that the city has been awarded an $850,000 federal grant to replace the light poles, sidewalks, street curbs, and gutters in the 100 block of South Market Street, part of the downtown corridor named in honor of his late predecessor, Jim Kingston, and to build curb bump outs at the northeast and northwest corners of the intersection of Market and Center Streets. The work, expected to be completed in 2027, is the second phase of the city's downtown streetscape improvement project. The $1.1 million first phase, completed in 2022 using money left over from the city's revolving loan fund that Kingston helped establish, included the resurfacing of four blocks of Market Street from Orleans to Home Street, the replacement of the light poles, curbs, gutters, and sidewalks in the 100 block of the North Market Street, and the construction of curb bumpouts at the intersections on each end of the 100 block of North Market Street. As soon as the first phase was finished, the city set out to secure state or federal grants to help fund further streetscape improvements, including sidewalk and light pole replacement in the 100 and 200 blocks of South Market Street and the 200 block of North Market Street, but with no immediate success. Finally, Ingold and other city leaders are seeing their efforts pay off, though. "We're really excited about getting it done," Ingold said. "It's something we've been working on for a long time. A lot of hoops to jump through. Even after Phase 2 is finished, there will still be more work to do. A potential Phase 3, involving sidewalk and light pole replacement in the 200 blocks of North and South Market Street, would finish this out," Ingold noted. The $850,000 grant should cover most of the cost of Phase 2, Ingold said, estimating that the city may need to contribute around $200,000 to $250,000 out of its general fund towards the work. "We've been saving up for it, so it's not a shock to the city finances," Ingold noted. "We've been putting some money aside." The Economic Development Initiative Community Funding Project Funding, EDICPF, grant was awarded by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, which notified the city earlier this month. EDICPF grant recipients are selected by Congress through the annual appropriations process. In Paxton's case, the congressional sponsor for the grant was U.S. Representative Robin Kelly, the Democrat from Illinois. "When I talked to the Congresswoman's office, they said that probably within the next 30 days, she or somebody on her staff will come over to Paxton and make a formal presentation," Ingold said. "We're going to get the check right away, though." Back on the front page, we have the second article regarding the improvements to be made. Paxton City Council takes action towards second TIF district's establishment. Paxton. The Paxton City Council approved a series of resolutions on Tuesday, May 12th, in preparation for the planned establishment of the city's second tax increment financing district. The proposed TIF district, known as TIF 2 for short, would comprise land south of West Ottawa Road, where developers have proposed building a sprawling three-phase residential subdivision that would also include some space, retail shops, and an assisted living facility, Mayor Bill Ingold said. However, the new TIF district would not include land north of Ottawa Road, where a gas station with a fast food restaurant is proposed to be constructed at the recently cleared former site of a shuttered car wash, as previously planned. Among action taken during the recent meeting, the council unanimously approved a resolution authorizing the execution of a contract with PGAV Planners, LLC, for the completion of a feasibility study and redevelopment plan for the proposed TIF district. PGAV Planners is a planning consulting firm based out of St. Louis, City Attorney Tony Shearing told the eight aldermen present. All they do is consulting work related to the implementation of a TIF. They do this all over the state. When the first TIF was established in 2012, the required feasibility study and redevelopment plan were completed by Shearing's late father, Dan, a Springfield attorney and TIF consultant. While Shearing said he can do the same work for TIF 2 as his dad did for TIF 1, PGAV Planners can do it faster and for less cost. This is something I can do, but I think it will get done faster and come with the kind of additional benefits of having been done by PGAV, Shearing said. It also allows us to focus specifically on some of the legal work that is going to have to be done in conjunction with the projects within the focused area that we're going to get started basically in parallel with the creation of the TIF district. Shearing said he broached the idea of hiring PGAV a week earlier when meeting with the mayor. Shearing then contacted PGAV, which was interested, he said. Because of the quick turnaround, they couldn't have anyone here tonight to speak to the council, Shearing said. But they are interested and able to do this. Shearing said PGAV has worked previously on studies for TIF districts in nearby communities like Rantoul, Leroy, Bloomington, and Champaign, plus Chicago, St. Louis, and Springfield, among other communities across the state. So they know how to do these and work on that piece specifically while we're continuing to work on some of the legal work. We have to do it anyway, whether we pay Tony or we pay PGAV, Ingold said before the 8-0 vote to move forward with the PGAV agreement. It's not going to make much difference one way or another. They are going to get it done a little faster and cheaper, Shearing added. Also at the meeting, the council approved a resolution authorizing the city to spend funds on the TIF feasibility study and to reimburse itself those costs if the future TIF proceeds. The third resolution approved at the meeting acknowledges that the Joseph H. Warner Dynasty Trust and the Gerald E. Warner Dynasty Trust, which owns the farmland south of Ottawa Road where the subdivision would be built, may seek to have certain costs incurred prior to the TIF district's creation reimbursed later via a potential redevelopment agreement with the city. Shearing said the city is planning for a second TIF district to accommodate the development on its west side instead of pursuing the alternative, more complicated option of seeking an extension of the first TIF district's 23-year lifespan and expanding it, too, to include all of the land that would have comprised of TIF 2. The land for the subdivision's first two phases is currently included in the city's first TIF district, meaning that land will need to be removed from the first TIF district then when the new one is created for the next 23 years. Also, the city would need to annex a couple of 100 acres of existing farmland comprising the subdivision's third phase and finalize redevelopment agreements negotiated with the developers. At some point, the city also plans to construct an extension of Elm Street south from Ottawa Road, which is also a state highway, Illinois 9, to allow for access to the proposed subdivision. The street extension was originally expected to happen last year at an estimated cost of $375,000. The 15-acre first phase of the 328-acre subdivision development would include 18 townhouse units, 8 single-family dwellings, and 4 duplexes, Engold said last fall. Phase 2 would be built later to the south of Phase 1, featuring a large 8-acre central park surrounded by homes, plus some commercial development to the north and west of those residents, including possibly restaurants or retail outlets, and an assisted living or independent living facility, developers have said. Phase 3, if eventually built, would include bigger residential lots south of Phase 2 and could also include walking trails and perhaps a stormwater detention basin behind the homes, the developers have said. Turning back to the front page, we have on the Rob Pacey case, police file on Rob Pacey investigation is 590 pages, but state police declined to release any records just yet. Springfield. The Illinois State Police have nearly 600 pages of paper records in their possession related to their investigation into claims of inappropriate touching of students by suspended Paxton Buckley-Loda teacher and former coach Rob Pacey. They are not giving them up, though, at least not all at once, anyway. In response to an April 29 Freedom of Information Act request by the Ford County Chronicle for all investigative reports related to any criminal allegations made against Pacey, State Police FOIA Officer Sarah Wheeler said in a May 13th email that ISP is unable to provide any records responsive to this request without disproportionately burdening our operations. Due to the size of the investigation, the number of records that conceivably be responsive to your request would burden the operations of the public body, Wheeler wrote. After an initial search, ISP has identified 590 pages of paper records that may be responsive to your request. The ISP FOIA unit would need to expend an inordinate number of personnel hours to review these records for possible exemptions, make any needed redactions, and finalize a response. The time required for this request would result in delays for other FOIA requests. Wheeler asked the Chronicle to narrow the scope of its request to manageable proportions. The Chronicle did so Wednesday, to include only the number of complaints and the dates those complaints were made, along with all documents outlining any findings of the investigation into those complaints. The Chronicle is awaiting a reply. In a sign that the investigation may already be finished, Wheeler did not cite an FOA provision allowing the withholding of information whose disclosure would, quote, interfere with pending or actually and reasonably contemplated law enforcement proceedings, unquote. An identical FOIA request submitted by the Chronicle to the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services was denied on May 6th. The agency's FOIA officer, Carl Gilmore, cited DCFS confidential policies and the state's Abused and Neglected Child Reporting Act, which restricts access to child abuse and neglected records to only the subject of the report or their representatives, with limited exceptions. The Freedom of Information Act exempts from disclosure any information specifically prohibited from disclosure by federal or state law, Gilmore noted. Meanwhile, as a result of a court order, the DCFS will be required to release all of its reports on the Pacey case, including all hotline calls received regarding his alleged misconduct since 2009, to the attorney for the 5 current and former students who filed lawsuits last year against Pacey, the PBL School District, PBL Junior High School Principal Josh Didier, and former superintendents Travis Dooley and Cliff McClure. The plaintiffs claim that the administrators were aware of a pattern of complaints of alleged sexual misconduct by Pacey, but never notified DCFS as required by law and the district's own policies. Per the court order, the DCFS will be required to release the unredacted information regarding the specific complaints initiated by the plaintiffs, while all other information is to be redacted, at least initially, to protect the names of the reporting parties. The information obtained via subpoena by the plaintiffs will be labeled as confidential in the court file as permitted under an existing protective order entered last fall. Another status hearing in the civil case is set for 1:30 p.m. Monday, June 15th. A deadline of Monday, June 22nd is set for the issuance of written discovery. And from the City Council, from last March's referendum, backyard hens to be discussed by City Panel. Rules in City's ordinance books could be changed based on ballot question outcome. Paxton. Paxton City Council members plan to meet sometime soon to discuss the topic of backyard chickens. During the Council's monthly meeting on Tuesday, May 12th, Alderman Dean Gyken, chairman of its License Permit Zoning Insurance Committee, said he would schedule a committee meeting in the near future once he consults his fellow committee members to determine an appropriate date. The committee is expected to discuss the results of a non-binding ballot question presented to local voters in March that asked if they would support the establishment of rules to allow for the keeping of backyard chickens in town. The final tally was 335 yes votes to 326 no votes. The committee also is expected to discuss the next steps, including whether to move forward with drafting new regulations to allow for backyard chickens. Gyken said he had hoped to have the committee meeting to discuss the topic at 6 p.m. May 12th, immediately prior to the regular council meeting, but those plans fizzled out due to the council's already busy meeting agenda. The committee meeting was tentatively postponed to 6 p.m. Tuesday, June 9th, but Gyken said that date will no longer work either, as a result of a meeting of the Council's Public Safety Committee already having been scheduled for that same time to discuss the local regulation of electric bikes and scooters. Gyken suggested the possibility of his committee meeting instead at 5 p.m. June 9th at City Hall, but Alderman agreed that back-to-back meetings with the regular monthly Council meeting included at 7 p.m. July 9th would not be preferred. As a result, Gyken said, "I think we're going to be having one earlier. I will be getting in contact with those on the committee," Gyken said, "and finding an appropriate date that we can get together. The meeting will be open to the public." While numerous nearby communities already allow backyard chickens, they currently can only be kept in Paxton if they are at least 150 feet from any home, church, school building, or public way, according to city code, restrictions that make raising them impossible on most residential properties. If new rules to allow backyard chickens were to be drafted by the council, they would then be heard at a public hearing by the city's Planning and Zoning Commission before the council for a final vote. Although the March 17th ballot question was non-binding, Alderman Kristen Larson, who has been advocating to allow for backyard chickens since October of 2020, before she joined the council, said she feels it would be a waste of our residents' time and frankly insulting if we did not follow the majority of votes and draft a new ordinance. Larson said the council already has a proposed backyard chicken ordinance in rough draft form. The draft includes having a pilot chicken keeping program, a permit process, inspections, a 6 to 18 limit, setbacks from neighbors' property lines, a non-compliance plan, an advocate to eliminate pressure on the police department, coop and run size standards and containment requirements, cleanliness restrictions, rooster prohibition, and more, Larson said last month. The goal is to allow residents to keep hens for personal, non-commercial use while not affecting neighbors in a negative way. Now we'll turn to the obituaries in the Ford County Chronicle for Wednesday, May 20th. Betty L. Beier, and that's spelled B-E-I-E-R, Cisna Park. Betty L. Beier, 93, of Cisna Park, died Friday, May 15th at Accolade Healthcare of Paxton on Pels. Funeral services were held Wednesday, May 20th at the Knapp Funeral Home in Cisna Park, with the Reverend Kevin Nouri officiating. Burial followed at the Apostolic Christian Cemetery in Cisna Park. Memorials may be made to the American Cancer Society or to the ALS Foundation. Geraldine Foley, Milford. Geraldine Jerry Foley, 80, of Milford, mother of a Paxton resident, died Wednesday, May 13th at her home. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, May 22nd at the Knapp Funeral Home in Milford. A memorial service will be at 11 a.m. Saturday, May 23rd at the funeral home, with the Reverend Brent Zastro officiating. Memorials may be made to the Milford Ambulance Service. Wallace F. Ganter, Paxton. Wallace Frederick Wally Ganter, died at 90, of Paxton, died at 11:37 a.m. Wednesday, May 13th at Carl Foundation Hospital in Urbana. A mass of Christian burial was held Tuesday, May 19th at St. Mary Catholic Church in Paxton, with Father Greg Scarron officiating. Burial followed in Glen Cemetery in Paxton with full military honors accorded by the Paxton American Legion Prairie Post 150. Memorials may be made to St. Mary Catholic Church in Paxton or to the Knights of Columbus. W. Quinlan, Rantoul. Scott William Quinlan, 48, of Rantoul, died unexpectedly on Tuesday, May 12th. Funeral services were held Thursday, May 21st at the Christian Life Church in Rantoul, with the Reverend Michael Johnson officiating. Burial followed in Beckman Center Cemetery in Rantoul. Memorial donations may be made to the Scott Quinlan Memorial Fund at the Bank of Rantoul. Kathleen Rolfing, Bloomington. Kathleen Dunman Rolfing, 80, of Bloomington, formerly of Paxton, died Thursday, May 7th. She will be interred privately at Glen Cemetery in Paxton. Memorial contributions may be made to the Huntington's Disease Society of America or to a charity of the donor's choice. Betty M. Smith, Saybrook. Betty Margaret Smith, 100, of Saybrook, died at 9:36 a.m. Thursday, May 14th, at Accolade Healthcare of Paxton Senior Living in Paxton. Funeral services were held Wednesday, May 20th, at the Calvert Belange Bruce Funeral Home in Saybrook, with the Reverend Stacy Landry officiating. Burial followed in Grandview Memorial Gardens in Champaign. Memorials may be made to a charity of the donor's choice. Brian M. Walnick, Paxton. Brian Michael Walnick, 55, of Paxton, formerly of Huntley, died Monday, May 11th at his home. Funeral services were held Saturday, May 16th at the Bear Family Funeral Service in Paxton, with Father Greg Scourin officiating. Burial followed in Glen Cemetery in Paxton. Memorials may be made to the Kim's Hope Foundation. And back on the front page we have, lawsuit claims $66,000 in loans to Horseradish remain unpaid. Shuttered Gibson City restaurant and co-owner sued. Gibson City. 4 days after the Horseradish announced its impending closure, citing unsustainable costs of keeping our doors open, a lawsuit was filed against the short-lived downtown Gibson City restaurant and its co-owner, Sam Horsch, claiming he failed to pay back more than $66,000 in loans from his ex-girlfriend to support the business. The five-count civil complaint was filed in Ford County Circuit Court on Monday, May 11th, by attorney Ellen Bullock of Champaign. On behalf of Sonia Stanzik, it seeks unspecified damages exceeding $50,000. According to the lawsuit, the unpaid loans made over a nearly three-year period were used by Horsch and the restaurant that he co-owned with his mother Barb to pay for the restaurant's payroll and buy a food trailer and truck for the restaurant, among other expenses. The total loaned but never paid back between July 2022 and August 2025 was $66,047, the complaint said. Horsch frequently requested loans from Sonia to cover restaurant expenses, including payroll, the lawsuit said. Horsch and the restaurant failed and/or refused to pay back the loaned fund, however, despite Sonia's repeated requests and demands. Horsch did not immediately reply to messages seeking comment on the lawsuit Friday, while his mother had no immediate comment. In addition to loaning money to Horsch and the restaurant, the lawsuit stated that Stanzik also paid an estimated $111,242 in shared expenses while living together for 3.5 years in Gibson City before ending their 7-year relationship in August 2025. She is not seeking repayment of any of those funds, though, which include $16,000 for rent, $14,400 for utilities, $28,424 for Horsch's health insurance, $12,711 for pet food and veterinary costs, $12,526 for food and groceries, $16,000 for meals at restaurants or bars, $8,000 in vacation and travel costs, and $3,181 for the purchase of a carport. Horsch represented to Sonia that while he was building the restaurant, it was appropriate for Sonia to assume responsibility for their shared expenses. Horsch stated those one-sided financial contributions would be temporary, the lawsuit said. In August 2024, Sonia raised concerns to Horsch and co-owner Barbara Horsch regarding the financial strain she's experienced as the result of covering substantially all of Horsch's personal living expenses for the past 3 years, as well as her growing concern about Horsch's accumulating personal credit card debt. Barbara told Sonia that she should pay Horsch's personal credit card expenses and compile their funds, stating that such arrangements are what spouses do. 4 days before the lawsuit was filed, the Horseradish announced it would be closing at the end of business on Sunday, May 17th. Unsustainable costs of keeping our doors open have brought us to this difficult decision, said the notice posted on Facebook. And that's all the time we have for this week's reading of the Ford County Chronicle. This is Tom Scott. I look forward to reading with you again very soon.